Welcome to the School's Northeast podcast, your source for deep dives into the critical issues facing our education system today and a space to explore the gap between educational policies and the realities experienced by those working tirelessly within our schools. We will also shine a light on our region's amazing schools, sharing their inspirational stories with a nationwide audience. Today, we're joined by Chris Zariga, Director of Schools Northeast, and Alex Fairlam, Assistant Principal of King's Priory School at the Schools Northeast Curriculum Conference 2024.
Welcome back everyone to the Schools Northeast podcast. Our next guest today is Alex Fairlam. Alex is an Assistant Principal of Teaching and Learning and a History Teacher. She is an SLE and an ELE, and her specialisms being History, T&L, and Diversity within the Curriculum. Who says there are too many acronyms in education. She's an NPQLL facilitator for Ambition Institute and the Three Rivers Teaching Hub. She's a secondary committee member of the Historical Association and co-editor of a forthcoming history curriculum book, What is History Teaching Now? Alex has presented nationally and internationally at research ed conferences and is a proud member of the School's North East Ed North Steering Group. Has been absolutely fabulous over a number of years helping us out and speaking at our various teaching and learning events. So thank you for joining us today, Alex. We're really excited to hear some of your thoughts on some of the questions we have. So to start us off, really important question for you. What's one thing that's made you smile this week?
That's a good question. I think one thing that has made me smile this week has been I got to write about a project that the school's fabulous art department did where they explored Black Tudors. And what we know is that there are no portraits of Black Tudor women in history. So using the narratives of Miranda Kaufman's book, they imagined what these Black Tudors would look like. And so they created those. They created an exhibit which showcased all of that. And it's now been put onto a national website, johnblank.com. And so this week I got to write about that and share that nationally, and the response to it has been absolutely fantastic. So really, really proud of the art department and the history department and the work that they've done.
Oh, brilliant. That's fantastic. If you could switch lives with any celebrity for a day, who would it be and why?
Oh, crikey. Does an edu celebrity count? I would probably say I would want to be probably Mary Myatt.
Mary Myatt,
because she is so kind, she is so giving of her time. She travels all around across the country to lend her expertise. As a woman in education, she really does put the ladder down for other women and is really supportive of diverse kind of curriculums, which is something which I specialise in. There is not anyone in education who has a bad word to say about her, because she is so knowledgeable, so full of expertise, and will absolutely go to the nth degree to support you. And she's just such a positive person. So if I could be her, what it's like to be in her shoes, have her knowledge, and to be able to empower as many people as she does and have the national impact that she does, I think that would be great.
Oh, fantastic. If anyone listening doesn't know who Mary Myatt is, then you should have come to the School's Northeast Curriculum Conference today. But if you go on our website, you'll find out all about her. And she is, yes, a very wonderful woman. Some more sort of serious questions about education and particularly Northeast schools. So do you, as a teaching practitioner at the Chalk Face, believe there's a disconnect between policymakers and the realities of being an educator in 2024?
To an extent, yes. I think, you know, the policymakers go into things with the best intent, and, you know, they do look at kind of aspects of research. And I think that they rightly have high expectations, and there has been a move towards more evidence-informed practice, which I think is really positive. They've really kind of worked on the intent of a curriculum that's rigorous, sequential, and rooted in progress for all. However, I think the implementation of it has been quite checkered, and I think that's where the issues have come to place. I think a lot of theory has been shared, for example, the Ofsted research reports, which are really useful insights into policy. And also, you know, kind of curriculum thinking, they are really, really powerful. But I think it's the more day-to-day on the ground stuff that greater support is needed. The support to implement hasn't been quite to the standard I think it could have been. And as a result, I think we've seen a lot of lethal mutations which have evolved as a result of it. And I feel that that's a lot to do with a lack of practical on the ground support. Christian Council recently wrote an article where she talked about the kind of the disconnect between knowledge rich, which was the intent, and how this has become information rich,
right?
With, you know, the Do Now retrieval quizzes and knowledge organisers, which are all powerful curriculum and pedagogical tools, but it's become a rote learning and pub quiz,
yeah,
rather than rich mental models and application rooted within context. And we can see that lack of support in the actual implementation leads to people on the ground who, in a high accountability sector, are seeking that silver bullet, that panacea.
Yeah.
I think as well, policymakers perhaps don't understand the context of the Northeast. You know, we have such a diverse area with small rural schools, with small staff numbers, who then find it hard to action curriculum development, because you might have one teacher teaching year three and year four, and then how do you develop a curriculum of 11 different subjects in primary school? And also, if you're not in a mat, you don't as well have like the whole scale numbers to enact kind of significant kind of large scale change.
Yeah. I mean, certainly the context piece is something that I absolutely agree that politicians just don't really understand under the hood of a region like the Northeast, or indeed every region to some extent is unique, but
yeah,
in the Northeast, particularly unique, if I can put it that way. But I was interested in what you said there about the lethal mutations. Mm-hmm. I mean, Christine's work is, Christine's spoken at them, I think it was our inaugural curriculum conference pre-COVID, yeah, very, very long time ago, and I think she spoke last year as well. Some very, very interesting ideas. So are you saying that politicians pick up on an idea, think it's a silver bullet, shove it onto the schools, but it's implemented in a really sort of checkered fashion?
I think so, or either they leave things exceptionally woolly, and as a result, these lethal mutations kind of, so they say knowledge rich, but what does that mean?
Yeah.
What does knowledge rich mean to a coastal school in Northumberland compared to a school in Liverpool? So without having those kind of, and I'm not looking for a prescriptive approach, far from it. It needs to be that, you know, we have autonomy as kind of schools and mats, but through the lack of practical support on the ground to kind of say, this is the common language that we're talking about. Here are some high evidence approaches which could benefit, but have a look at your context. And it's everything that the MPQs kind of advocate in terms of, you know, you can see practice happening in one school and that's great that it's having that impact. But then what will happen is then people will select that strategy and just implement it without thinking, what are the real problems in our school? Have we thoroughly diagnosed it through triangulation, and what therefore would be the most appropriate strategy? And I think having that lack of clarity and actually people going into schools and working with them on the ground, we have seen people kind of clutching at things where they've seen have had positive impacts elsewhere and implementing them without kind of due diligence in their own context.
Yeah. So how do you bridge that gap? You know, so it's a common message that we get from teachers, support staff, senior leaders, etc. You know, so how do you get it across to them that, you know, that something's wrong? There's really good intentions, as you said. You know, no policymaker goes out to say, let's come up with a really rubbish policy, let's really knack up that school. So you know, how do you think you can best bridge that gap?
I think there's some big things. I mean, the obvious ones are time and money. Funding and support for schools to actually develop their curriculums. So, you know, through conversations quite often it'll be, you know, we've read this really great book, but how do I create time for my HODs to be able to develop this with their teams?
Yeah.
So that ability to free up time within the timetable or the busy ecosystem of a day for them to actually put into action the theory and research that they're reading, and to cover staff to access subject specific, I think really importantly, subject specific development as well. I think MPQs have been really great, and it would be great to see more subject-specific ones.
Right.
Institutions or associations like the Historical Association have middle leader development programmes, which have been really phenomenal and transforming practice.
Are they funded, though? Or?
So those ones which have to be paid for. So and again, that's where that funding aspect of it comes from. So granting access using the skills and expertise of the Geographical Association, Historical Association, NATRA, to really kind of help practitioners to hone the curriculum within subject disciplinary areas would be really, really fantastic, and perhaps look at mentoring opportunities as well. I think a big thing which has got to be looked at, and I imagine it's very much on the way, is GCSE and A-level reform. I think, as Christian Council kind of talks about too often, the specifications are seen as the curriculum. And as a result of that, we see this backwash, and we saw that with the eradication of national curriculum levels, with GCSE being backwashed. So I think the more that we can make changes to A-level and GCSE specifications, which means that yes, we have these tight-knit specifications, but we can go above and beyond hinterland and world building to provide rich curriculum opportunities which can be rooted in local context, then I think that will then lead to Key Stage 3 and below having that greater freedom and autonomy to go above and beyond the national curriculum.
I mean, that kind of touches on the next question, which is, you know, what specifically do you think the North East is lacking in terms of support from policymakers?
It's always going to come back to funding.
Funding,
practical support on the ground, that levelling up. We need that practical support on the ground. You know, quite often we're pointed towards examples which are southern-centric or not context-based. Or we'll have like an expert that will come in and do kind of like, you know, a really transformational inset, and then that's it, it's kind of done. So I think funding in terms of the deployment of support over a sustained period of time, so it's not ad hoc, it's one-off.
Yeah.
So that if there are people who can really help with the individual issues and context of our local schools, that they can work with us over a 2 or 3 year period. As we know, change is slow. Dylan Williams talks about that and says it's important that change is slow. And how it is that they can work with us to create kind of 3, 4, or 5 year development plans with their expertise supporting us in really kind of rigorous ways. And
a point that can't really be overstressed. I mean, education is almost unique in the sense of the number of initiatives that are fired off and then forgotten and then fired off again.
Yeah.
You know, so as you say, change takes a long time and needs to take a long time to bed in.
Yeah.
But also linked to that, one of our speakers this morning, Peter Sager, spoke about the national curriculum and having a more sort of northeast version of that to develop pride with children in their place, give them a sense of their history and their family's history. Do you think that's a specific issue that holds the northeast back?
So it was interesting. So during his talk, I was sat there and I was scribbling away, because I know myself and Neet, who I've sat next to, you know, we have worked really hard to make sure that there is a local context which goes throughout our curriculums. You know, I'm really proud of the history curriculum that we've created at our school in terms of that. So I think that if schools feel confident to go above and beyond the national curriculum, really look at the way that they interpret the national curriculum. So if we look at Key Stage 1, it's got significant individuals, it's got significant national events, significant local events. Rather than doing a significant national event, Great Fire of London, significant person, Nelson Mandela, significant local person, Grace Darling, which creates a chronological disconnect anyway. Actually, let's look at the Industrial Revolution. Let's look at George Stephenson, what he did nationally in terms of Manchester and Liverpool railways, locally in terms of the Wagonways and Puffing Billy, and look at the Great Fire of Gateshead and things like that. So there are lots of really, really opportunities, and I think the rich heritage of our region, the literature, the history, the geography can really successfully be woven into our curriculums and the cultural capital opportunities. But it's that time, because knowing about all these local aspects that we can weave in requires the thought and mental capacity to find out about those and meaningfully thread them through, so that local aspects are not just a bolt-on, they're woven throughout, and we need time for staff to research that, to come together, to collaborate, and, you know, meaningfully forge that into their progression models.
Yeah. So essentially what you were saying earlier about time for collaboration and subject-specific, I guess that's the issue. That if we want to change the curriculum in ways like that, it will take a long time, because current teachers are trained in a certain way, and it will take quite a bit of extra time to be able to move them on from that model. So in terms of policies though, what do you think are the ones that have had the most noticeable impact on you, on student learning outcomes, that kind of thing, either good or bad, anything springs to mind as worthy of mention or opprobrium?
I think the greater focus on reading and literacy has been something quite positive. So the DfE reading documents, I'm going to hold my hands up and say that as a secondary practitioner, I was never taught how to teach reading.
Yeah.
And therefore, the assumption was is that they come to secondary school and they have that ability to read. Yeah. And actually, when you have a look at it, you know, as Alex Quigley says, we're expecting them to read to learn when they're still learning to read. And we weren't taught about phonics and morphology and the importance of reading interventions. So we were, you know, slamming down textbooks in front of these children and not understanding why they couldn't access it. So I think the greater focus on kind of different reading, such as whole class reading, phonics interventions and upskilling staff has been really positive. But again, the downside of that has been, yes, we've got the MPQLL, but where is that greater support on the ground? Because we are seeing lethal mutations in schools, right, again, which come as a result of it, where reading is something to be done rather than something to be... We've got 20 minutes today and we've got to do whole class reading. And actually the preparation for staff such as myself, who, you know, weren't ever taught how to read, you know, we're given reading ages. We're very careful in our context to make sure, okay, we've got reading ages. How do we scaffold, therefore, for that student?
Yeah.
Whereas in some places it could be, here's the reading ages, and you're expected to know how to teach reading when you haven't got that.
Yeah.
So I think that's been really positive, but there is that lethal mutation concern. But I think one thing that worries me is there are so many changes going on, and there's not been a period of sustainability and embedding. And what I've seen recently has been kind of talks about further changes like maths until 18, and I'm unsure of the research and rationale behind it, including how it'll be staffed. And the energy required to try and meet this potential need will then detract from resources for more pressing curriculum issues and more likely lead in poorly executed implementation of this approach. And I know Labour have kind of talked about whole-scale curriculum change. Well, we've been doing that since 2019.
Yeah, yeah.
If we're going to create a retention and recruitment crisis, that will add to it.
Do the words wholesale change send a shiver up your spine as a teacher?
Yeah.
Because I can't think of a period. I've been involved with schools now since 2004, and I can't think of a period from Every Child Matters through to
back.
I mean, there's too many to remember. They all just blur. And I think that's part of the problem. The DfE doesn't remember them either, and then rules out the same. Sometimes rules out the same projects that failed 10 or 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But what do you think in terms of change needs to be done for education, even if it's just put the brakes on?
I think, you know, one thing is a proper diagnosis of issues within school. Like, I think, you know, it does really require policy makers to go into schools, warts and all, not like a showcase for kind of the celebrities coming in and experience what it's like for 2 weeks on the ground as a full timetable teacher, as to what are the difficulties in terms of behaviour, curriculum, teaching and learning, and what are the great opportunities from it as well. I think there needs to be that proper diagnosis of issues within school, and for me, it's hard to know if the previous changes or policies which have been introduced could have a positive impact because they're cut short so early on in life and, you know, a new specification comes about. So I think, you know, what we need to do is really spend the energy in looking at what are the real problems which are affecting our schools and having a look at the best bets approach which could be effectively implemented in ways which are autonomous to the school without lethal mutations, with that practical support. Because we do know that there are tweaks within the curriculum that need to be made, such as greater amount of diversity. And that doesn't mean that we have to do a whole-scale change. That just means that we need to support specialists to go into schools to work over a sustained period of time in adapting the already existing curriculum and moving it forward, because curriculum is organic. It's about iterations. It's not about wiping the slate clean and starting again. It's about trialling it, evaluating it, looking at the impact, and then moving it forward into its next iteration.
Yeah. It's interesting what you said. It's come up a few times with other guests on the podcast, but in terms of the specific policies that you think have had the most impact, you said reading and literacy. That's come out over and over, and I think it was Christine Kemsley who said, you know, every day read thousands of words, write thousands of words. That's a very positive step forward in education. What about the ones that have held you back? Do you name one that you think should just never have been or should be dropped now that's having a disproportionate impact on you and your students?
I would probably say it's more so the kind of, I think it's more so the future ones that are coming. I wouldn't probably say that any policy has been negative, because that would be me speaking from my own individual kind of context, and that might have been something which has worked in kind of other contexts. I think a real shame though has been that, and you know, I am an EBAC subject, I am a historian. I think one of the things has been the diminishing numbers of MFL. I know that's an EBAC subject, but in the Northeast, MFL numbers are dropping.
Yeah.
But when we look at creative subjects such as music, art and drama, the amount that that is diminishing within curriculums, I don't know if, I wouldn't say that that's wholly the responsibility of policymakers in terms of what they've introduced, but well, the EBAC did place precedent on it.
Yeah, an interesting question, because when you look at EBAC levels, the Northeast versus the rest of the country, we're often slated for being below other areas. That our levels, our percentage of students doing doing it are too low, whatever too low means. But when you strip out modern foreign languages, then we have essentially the same rates as everybody else. Mm-hmm. When you look at the recruitment figures for the Northeast, MFL is a massive issue. You know, so is that more, that's not down to Northeast students or Northeast schools, that's more down to Northeast infrastructure.
I completely agree, and I think that comes back to the retention and recruitment crisis in terms of, you know, we are struggling to recruit MFL teachers up in the north, so therefore it becomes that subjects get cut, particularly kind of at A level. So what can we do which will help to reinforce the importance of languages in the region and attract more people to the profession, more MFL linguists to come into the profession and teach our young people, because languages are so, so important. And I think, you know, part of it, an issue is that the government has created a bit of a hierarchy of teachers in terms of, you know, what physics teachers get paid compared to your MFL teachers, your history teachers. And it does kind of create this kind of, this unwelcome kind of sense of like who's of greater importance. But I do think that there needs to be greater focus on creative subjects, because music is such an amazing subject. What the children gain from that is beyond what I can explain, and the interdisciplinary aspects that you can build in within your curriculum. So I think they really need to look at how, a bit like with the hierarchy of teachers, have they created a hierarchy of subjects? And within that, how do they make sure that, yes, we have the core maths and English, and the amount of times I have students saying, oh, I'm not going to revise for history because I've got maths and English to focus on and they're most important. I would love it to be of equal importance, that each subject is celebrated as the unique and wonderful subject that it is of equal importance.
And I guess, I mean, there definitely is a hierarchy that's been established there in terms of, you know, what some people in inverted commas call proper subjects, that's a subject for a whole different podcast. But do children recognise that hierarchy, or do they drop out if the hierarchy doesn't fit with what their needs are in an average Northeast school?
I think kids are incredibly perceptive. It's almost like they can smell the blood in the water sometimes. Like they are so
children
more
are
perceptive.
Like
that's my statement. So you know they're aware of what the national kind of mantra is. They know how much time is invested in English and maths, and where intervention is greater focused and things like that.
Yeah.
That's the same in every school. So children are aware of that, and then that can affect kind of, you know, what they then decide to place effort in terms of revision, engagement and lessons, despite all of the significant amount of hard work that practitioners do on a day-to-day basis to make sure
really
that their curriculum is enriching.
You know, if you looked at the NTP figures and then examined where schools spent it, how many of them spent it on tuition and music or something that had a developed cultural capital or whatever, that would be really interesting.
Yeah. And I think that gets then echoed at sixth form level, and you know we've got issues such as in, you know, nationally and in the Northeast and England, the amount of institutions who are providing history at Sunderland University's history department is closed. So that echoes then back to our children who say, well, where can I afford to study history in the Northeast? Therefore I'm going to go with a subject which I can afford to do at university nearby.
No, they're very, very rational. Children are far more rational, we give them credit for it.
They are.
One final question for you, and you're not allowed to say don't do it. What is one piece of advice you would give someone wanting to pursue a career similar to yours?
I would say definitely do it. Realistic about the expectations of it, and avoid kind of demonising headlines. But what I would say is that feeling that you get in the classroom is unlike any other rush that you can ever experience. When that kid either gains an incredible piece of knowledge and uses it powerfully, or says something ridiculously silly and stupid and it just has you in tears stitching, the joy that those children bring to your life, I literally can't put it into words. So my advice would be to go and get some work experience, go and visit as many different schools, primary and secondary, in different contexts, and really see what the reality of the lay of the ground is, and speak to teachers about kind of what would be realistic steps in a particular subject or phase area to help them to kind of gain those steps to knowing what they need to do, what it will feel like, where the sources of support are, how they can safeguard their well-being, but more importantly, the positives and opportunities that come from it.
Brilliant. No, that's a fantastic answer. Thank you very much for joining us today, Alex.
Thank you.
I hope you haven't found it too grueling, but that was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
A huge thank you to Alex for joining us at the Curriculum Conference. And that wraps up today's episode. Thank you for tuning in to the Schools North East podcast. Next time, we have a slightly different episode. We'll be featuring a Q&A session with Education Advisor Mary Myatt, all about school curriculum. If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure you subscribe to the Schools North East podcast, and we will see you next time.